This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The seesaw standoff between Britain and Iran looks a bit better today. Iranian state radio reports positive changes from Britain. While in London, a British official said that Britain has agreed to consider talks on how to avoid similar disputes in the future. Nevertheless, 15 British sailors and Marines remain in Iranian custody. In part, this dispute focuses on exactly where they were when they were seized, and there's also concern about their treatment. But on both sides, the crisis has escalated to include domestic politics, both countries' role in Iraq, United Nations sanctions, and the long-running argument over Iran's nuclear ambitions. And so far, there's no solution in sight. Later in the program, on the opinion page, should public libraries be open to the homeless? But first, the standoff between Britain and Iran. How much of this dispute is domestic politics? How much international? What are the risks and the possible rewards? How much of this involves the United States? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us first from the town of Hale in Cornwall, England, is Scott Bingham. He's defense correspondent for BBC Radio Southwest. He's been talking to locals in Hale, a town where one of the British sailors calls home. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here, Neil.
And home is Hale is home to Nathan Summers. What's the mood like there?
Well, I think, Neil, there's an overwhelming sense of support here. It's a beautiful day today. We've been out on the streets. Hale is a pretty small town. HMS Cornwall actually hails, if you forgive the pun, from Plymouth, which is about an hour and a half away from here. That's very much a naval town. The naval base at Devonport there is the largest in Western Europe. That said, there is a close-knit maritime and naval community in the city. Families have been supporting each other at this difficult time, and the Royal Navy also has a tried and tested support network in place. Teams from the Navy Personal and Family Service are available to offer practical support, emotional support, even counselling if necessary to the families of those involved. Now, it has to be said that perhaps understandably the families haven't been too keen to talk to the media over this, and any that have spoken to us have since been discouraged basically from doing so by the Ministry of Defence. Now, here in Hale today, that's where, as you said, Nathan Summers, he's a 21-year-old Royal Navy sailor. He lives here in the Cornish town of Hale. I've spent much of today here, and there is a tremendous support for these captives. The yellow ribbons are out on display. They're relatively unusual for us. I know you guys have them on display all the time for your troops, but as I said, pretty unusual over here. There is also a little concern, mainly over the way that they are perhaps being treated and the fact that they're being paraded on television. But the overwhelming sort of sense of support is what really comes across, and the will to see these people back home with their families as soon as possible.
And as you mentioned, a little further along up the coast in Plymouth, of course, a British naval base since the days of Sir Francis Drake, is the feeling, as you say, of support, or is the feeling that at this point they want the government to do something about this?
I think it's very mixed, basically. Plymouth is a much bigger city than Hale, where I've been today. It's a much bigger community. But again, there is this close-knit, sort of concentrated sort of maritime and naval community around the naval base there. Now, there is support, as I said, for these families, and there is a sense, I guess, on the streets, there is a growing sort of sense of frustration that there doesn't appear up till now, you know, this has gone on for 10 days, there doesn't appear to have been a great deal of movement. It just seems to have been a sense of sort of political posturing, if you like. People want to see some sort of movement, and I think there's also a sense of relief now that today with this this sort of improvements in sort of diplomatic relationships and this sort of positive change in the stance, the diplomatic stance, if you like, that people are sort of getting a sense of hope that actually we may see we may be moving closer to a release.
Mm-hmm. How are people responding to what the government has been doing? Of course, the Prime Minister, Blair, says Britain will neither apologize nor negotiate, that they insist on unconditional release.
I think there's always this a sense of kind of support in Britain for that firm sort of stance. Obviously, in the sort of local communities on the ground where people perhaps know these captives, and obviously amongst their sort of friends and families, there's a different element to that. People obviously want to see steps taken to secure their release, and if that means sort of some form of compromise and a slight sort of softening of the approach, if you like, from the British government, then I think people are keen to see that and keen to, as I said, basically to get these people back home.
Scott Bingham, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Scott Bingham, defense correspondent for BBC, or correspondent for BBC Radio Southwest. He's been speaking with us from the town of Hale in Cornwall, home to one of the captives being held in Iran. Joining us now on the line from London is Ed Owen, for many years political advisor to former British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw. And we thank you for taking the time today.
Hi, Neil.
And Britain's options seem fairly limited right now.
Yeah, it's tough. This is tough diplomacy, really. There's no easy option here. There's not a military option to this crisis. So the British government is spending a great deal of time both with its own Iranian contacts, and unlike, of course, America, Britain does have diplomatic relations with Iran, as well as working with allies like America, allies in the UN, allies in the European Union, to bring what pressure can be brought on the Iranian regime.
Yet every time pressure seems to be applied, Iran, for example, objected to the idea of taking this to the United Nations.
The Iran, Neil, did you say?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, sure. No, this is very difficult. And the difficulty is that the Iranian government is a very, very difficult beast to deal with. It's not really one government at all. It's two governments. There's a spiritual government, the religious government, which holds a lot of the power, particularly in the security apparatus. So there's a lot of evidence that suggests that these sort of military maneuvers, which resulted in these servicemen and women being taken, was to some extent related to orders from Tehran, from the spiritual religious government in Iran, as well as then the civilian government. Now, actually, we're dealing with, at the moment in Iran, where those two governments are closer together than they have been for some years, but it's still a very, very difficult situation. There are people in Iran who like to see confrontation, who see the best way of dealing with the West, dealing with Britain and other governments, is to confront, is to produce these sort of shows of demonstrations of power. There are others who actually sensibly regard engagement and further discourse and dialogue with the West as a good thing, and would be shaking their heads in despair at what's happening, and having to, for the British government to be negotiating and manoeuvring through this thicket of diplomatic complexity is very difficult.
Do British people feel to some degree that they've been singled out as sort of an American ally in this, as sort of a proxy for the United States?
Well, as you know, and your listeners know, the war in Iraq was very controversial here in the UK, and there is a strong body of public opinion that regards Britain's involvement in the war as a mistake, and that has often been weaved into a view about the weaknesses, if you like, for mm-hmm. Britain being so closely identified with the US. But I don't think, in general, that is regarded as an issue. I think most people regard the fact that what the British troops on this mission were doing was for the good. It was for the good of Iraq. It was for the good of the civilian government in Iraq and Iraq's economic future. And I think that there's not very much of that. I think the overwhelming view, I think, is, as the BBC correspondent was saying to you earlier, is that people want to get these people home. I think there is. Well, I think I would differ with the view that the BBC correspondent would put. I think there is some degree, in some elements, a sort of certainly frustration, and to some extent a degree of anger that Britain is not able to deal with this situation immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that's understandable, but of course, as I said before, this is a very difficult situation. It's probably going to take a long time. It's going to take a hell of a lot of diplomatic work. And while I'm not suggesting there's an exact comparison here at all, the situation is very different. But if you remember, of course, back to the American hostages in Iran 20-odd years ago. Mm-hmm. This takes a long time, and there's no easy, quick fix.
444 days, if I'm not mistaken, on that count. And nevertheless, this also comes on the 25th anniversary of the Falklands War, a time when Britain took much more decisive action. And I'm sure that that comparison has not escaped analogy in the newspapers and broadcast as well.
Yes, I suppose it's an interesting coincidence of issues, as you say. And I think people, some people do feel sort of frustrated by that. I mean, actually, if it's on a more objective basis, there is no military option for this issue. I'm afraid it's just simply not on the table. There is some questions I think that some people have as to why, when these service people were taken by the Iranian troops, there wasn't more robust action taken at that stage to ensure that the British troops were not
taken. The ship HMS Cornwall was right there.
But I think this reflects very much, well, two things. Firstly, a sort of British tradition, which is more consensual, and of course our troops there are not there to fight the Iranians. This is not their mission. Their mission is there to support UN resolutions, and their mission, in that specific case, was to patrol that waterway to and engage criminal activity and smuggling, which was undermining the effort to provide good distribution of oil that would support the Iraqi economy. So the mission there was not a aggressive one to Iran. So I think rightly the default of the British commanders on the ground was to at first to see whether this issue could be resolved amicably, because it could have easily been a mistake.
And it was 3 years ago, a very similar incident.
Yeah, I mean, it took a while 3 years ago, but it was resolved in the end, and I think that there was hope that it could be resolved in a matter of hours or even days. Now, that hasn't proved to be the case, and rather pessimistically, I'm afraid, I think it took quite a period in 2004. I can't now remember exactly how long, but it was a week or 2 weeks before we got asked.
Mm-hmm. Ed Owen, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Ed Owen was a political advisor to former British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, with us today on the line from London. When we come back, we'll talk about Iran's risks and options in this situation. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 10 days ago, Iranian forces captured 15 British sailors and Marines aboard small boats that came from a frigate, HMS Cornwall, in waters in the northern Persian Gulf off the disputed area off the coast of the Shatt al-Arab, the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates River. Iran wants Britain to apologize for allowing the sailors to enter Iranian waters. Britain says they were in Iraqi waters, and it demands unconditional release. We're talking about the politics of this standoff. And joining us now in Studio 3A is Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council. Nice to have you back on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join in on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And Trita Parsi, this may have originated as a local incident. It may not have. But whatever's happened, it's certainly blown up into an international crisis.
Absolutely. And I think that's the key thing to remember here. This may very well have been a small incident in which the Iranians may have thought that the Brits were in Iranian waters. Perhaps the Brits were in Iranian waters. But the reason why something like this has blown up to become this major international incident is because of the political context that is taking place in which Iran and the West is at a major standoff over various number of issues, particularly the nuclear ambitions of Iran, the nuclear program in Iran, which the Iranians say is entirely peaceful, and the United States suspects that it is not.
And others.
And others as well.
The coincidence is the day these sailors were seized, the United Nations passed its latest set of sanctions against Iran for its refusal to abide by the dictates of the
A couple of days after this incident, there was a second UN resolution that increased the sanctions on Iran just a notch or two. It wasn't particularly hawkish, but it was still a defeat for the Iranians in the sense that the Security Council reacted rather quickly to their passing of the previous deadline and the fact that it was a unanimously approved UN Security Council resolution.
And there's another factor that goes into this, and that is that several Iranians, particularly five men, seized at what the Iranians called a diplomatic mission, and the United States says it wasn't. But anyway, the United States says they are intelligence agents and were captured inside Iraq in Mosul, and that the Iranians want them back, and maybe there could be some quid pro quo.
I don't think they're looking for a quid pro quo necessarily, but I think what this probably is that back in December 2006, when the Bush administration was under a lot of pressure to negotiate with the Iranians, the Bush administration came out and said they can't negotiate at this time because they don't have the leverage. Iran is holding all the cards, and that this needed to change before any negotiations could take place. And immediately after that, you started to see U.S. forces arresting Iranian diplomats, arresting Iranian personnel inside of Iraq. Those people have still been held in Iraq somewhere. The Iranians have had no access to them. And at least two of them have been diplomats, several of them else. Their status is disputed. I think what this may be is a response from the Iranians saying, if it is okay for the United States to abduct Iranian personnel in order to get leverage for a future potential negotiation, well, then the Iranians can play the same game and they can also target coalition forces and take them in order to gain leverage over the U.S. The problem with all of this, of course, is that none of these countries are increasing their leverage. All they're doing is that they're closing the diplomatic window.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, if those had been American sailors and Marines that the Iranians had captured, this might be a very different story.
Absolutely. I think just as much as the Iranians are a soft target for the U.S., I think the U.S. feels rather comfortable being able to take Iranian diplomats in Iraq without necessarily fearing too many repercussions. I think the Brits are soft targets for the Iranians in the sense that you can escalate it by taking the Brits, but it's a controlled escalation. Had you targeted American personnel, then it would have been an uncontrolled escalation, and we may have seen a much, much greater military confrontation ensue.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on the conversation. Again, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. This is Josh. Josh with us from South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the disputed nature of the waters where the British sailors were captured. I mean, obviously, I think everyone hopes they're returned safely, but I think it's the point kind of gets lost in all the tension already in the region that, you know, as far as the Iranians concerned, they were in Iranian waters and the Brits see it otherwise. And to kind of have this standoff over something that most people can understand the dispute to me seems to be just too much fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, Trita Parsi, the first position actually released by the Iranians where they said they captured the Brits was in Iraqi waters, and then they corrected it, and they said the GPS equipment that the British sailors had showed that they were in Iranian waters, and the British says, look, we flew a helicopter over the spot where all this happened. It's clearly in Iraqi waters. There's not a dispute necessarily where the line is. It's a dispute with which side the boat was on.
Well, that is the British side of the story in the sense that they say that the Iranians first agreed to a position that was in Iraqi waters. I have not heard that coming from the Iranians. I think it's really difficult to be able to say where they actually were. The British have produced some evidence that they say indicates that their sailors were in Iraqi waters with the GPS and showing where the Indian boat was and where the helicopter mm-hmm. that was hovering above that boat was.
Just to clarify, the British sailors were inspecting an Indian vessel suspected of smuggling. They didn't find anything on it. That's why they were on a small boat off of HMS Cornwall. They were heading back to the frigate when this happened.
Exactly. And then the Iranians confiscated the GPS instruments of the British, at least one of the GPS instruments. And that one showed that not only, according to the Iranians, not only were they in Iranian waters at that time, but also at five previous moments. And there is a lot of tension, not only because of this, but there's a bad history between Iran and Britain. Britain had a major role in overthrowing the democratically elected prime minister of Iran in 1953. Recently, there's been a lot of bombings taking place on the Iranian side of the border with ethnic separatists that the Iranians suspect are supported or tacitly supported by the British because they're based in on the Iraqi side where the Brits are in control. So there's a lot of different factors that is really complicating this issue and making it much...
Vice versa, too. The British in southern Iraq believe the Iranians are behind some of the attacks on their forces.
Absolutely. Well, actually, they have not been as... they haven't spoken out as strongly as the U.S. may have done. Their indications have gone in different directions on this issue. But nevertheless, there's a lot of different tensions there, which then makes this issue so much bigger than just where were the sailors and where does the boundary go.
Josh, thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we can go to, this is Travis. Travis with us from Sun Valley in Idaho.
Correct. Yeah, my question is this. Your guests kind of refer to the British forces as being soft targets. Has the British military reputation decreased since, say, Margaret Thatcher and the era of the Iron Maiden so much that they would even attempt that?
Mm.
And, you know, would the Iranians even think about doing that back when, you know, she was the Iron Maiden and she was in charge without worrying about, like, you know, the SAS, you know, stepping through Tehran to get their guys back?
British reputation or British capabilities, Trita Parsi.
Yeah.
Well, there's a much of this context that has changed. The caller accurately points out that Margaret Thatcher is not around anymore. And that's absolutely true, and that's an important
factor.
Still
around, but not in charge.
But there are other factors involved as well, which one is that the British public in general tends to view the British involvement in Iraq as a major mistake that has overstretched Britain's abilities, not only militarily, but also diplomatically.
But so what about the reputation of their military? I mean, there was a time during the 80s when, you know, like when the British SAS went into the Libyan embassy, you know, the British SAS has operated extensively throughout the Middle East, when it just was understood that if you did something to their men, you might very well have, you know, the leader of the British, the Britain, was more than willing to send off guys in the middle of the night to deal with you.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to take a look at this in relative terms, in the sense that compared to the Americans, the Brits are a soft target, regardless of what their reputation was 25 years ago.
Mm. Thanks for the call, Travis.
No problem.
Okay. The larger questions that revolve around this was brought up by our earlier guest, Ed Owen, saying, look, we're not ever quite sure which government we're dealing with in Iran, whether this was a rogue operation put forward by hardliners who were looking for an opportunity to put the pressure on domestically their rivals in Tehran.
Absolutely. Anything that deals with Iran sooner or later becomes a domestic issue just as much as is the case with the United States or any other country. Domestic politics always come into play to this. But one of the things that I think is quite interesting is that the previous guest, Ed Owen, when he was involved in advising Jack Straw, then the Brits used the diplomacy that they're so famous for, and they managed to resolve this rather quickly. Mm-hmm. What I'm really surprised about this situation is actually the rather incompetent way that the Tony Blair government have been dealing with this, in the sense that the Brits have, they're masters of diplomacy, they know how to get their men out, and if they need to do anything afterwards, they'll do it afterwards. But first of all, they play it softly and they get their men out. Mm-hmm. The way the British government has played it now, they actually seem to have been taking a couple of pages out of George W. Bush's book on diplomacy. And that's not really that successful.
Well, to be fair to say, it was the Tony Blair government 3 years ago when it was handled much
more
successfully.
It was, but it was Jack Straw that was dealing with it. And I think that's a major difference between him and the current foreign secretary.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Barry. Barry's with us from Grants Pass in Oregon.
Yeah, I certainly don't support Iran at all. But due to the advanced technological satellite ability that Britain and America has, including AWACS, it's hard for me to believe that we haven't received information that shows exactly what occurred in that area. And not only that, I would have to believe, due to the computerized technology, that there would not even been an alarm set off when a vessel entered even close to that area.
You have to believe, Trita Parsi, that electronic information gathered from HMS Cornwall would have definitive information, whether that was universally believed or not. It should be definitive.
True, but then it comes into the issue of the disputed waterway. Where does the boundary exactly go? And I've spoken to experts that say that actually this GPS system is not as reliable as a lot of people tend to think.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the bigger point is, this is an issue that can be resolved rather easily if it wasn't taking place within the context of this major, major conflict between these two
sides. At some point, it would be easy to say, oh, we miscalculated, or there might have been room for misunderstanding. So sorry, here are your men back. We won't do it again.
Absolutely.
We didn't do it, and we won't do it again.
Absolutely. And I think not only has the Brits not necessarily played their cards as well as they usually do, but obviously the Iranians have not made it much easier for the Brits by, for instance, showing the personnel on TV and doing kind of things that really rallies the public opinion in Britain and makes it more difficult for the Tony Blair government to be able to pursue a much more quiet, softer diplomatic approach.
And then yesterday, and by the way, thanks for the call, Barry. Yesterday, there's a giant demonstration outside the British embassy in Tehran, people throwing rocks and firecrackers and apparently needing to be restrained by riot police.
Exactly. I think it was about 200 people there, which I wouldn't characterize as a giant demonstration.
Right,
in
we've
Iran.
Seen much bigger ones, yes.
Definitely, we've seen much bigger ones. Exactly. And the Iranians have used this for domestic political purposes as well. And that's the really sad thing about this. Both sides are making it so difficult to go to the negotiating table without first trying to get a little bit extra leverage. And that attempt to get extra leverage, this duel for leverage, is making it so much more difficult for diplomacy to work. That is not just in the case of these British sailors, but also in the larger scheme of things when we take a look at the nuclear situation. If negotiations had taken place much earlier without any preconditions, it is quite likely that situations like this would have been resolved in 3 to 4 days.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Trita Parsi, lecturer in international relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies here in Washington and president of the National Iranian American Council. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Doug on the line. Doug with us from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say that in any dispute like this, the first step is to acknowledge your opponent's position and kind of melt the ice. And I think that the English should just say, we don't know. We don't think they were in your waters. You do. Okay, if they were in your waters, then we apologize for it. And let's talk about the fact that we certainly would not want to violate your sovereignty, and we don't want you to violate ours. Then you're working with each other, whether you admit that you did it or not, you're still working from a cooperative point of view, and it's amazing what happens. I mean, that's the way most people solve their disputes. That's the best way rather than taking a hard line.
Not to argue their point of view, said, look, we know where we were. We were in Iraqi waters. These are sailors and Marines performing a mission sanctioned by the United Nations. This is not part of the war in Iraq. This is part of an inspections regime that's been going on before that happened and will continue after that happens. And we did nothing wrong.
Well, are you just getting into a hard? And the Iranians then say, yes, you did. So the matter is, you just have to acknowledge each other and say, well, if we did, we apologize. We don't think we did. You're not giving away anything. You're just listening to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first step into solving any problem.
Now, Trita Parsi,
to the other person.
Sometimes easier said than done, though.
It is,
well,
but I have to
a lot easier than people are letting on, I think.
I would actually agree with the caller to a large extent and say, if anything, the Brits are actually masters at doing that, making sure that they can acknowledge the other side, not necessarily give in on the issue, but smoothing things out and make sure that they can get their personnel back. And that was simply not done this time. Rather, Tony Blair was using language that whether they're right or wrong is simply not helpful towards resolving this. And clearly, the Iranians have not done a lot to be making this easier either by parading the people on TV, etc.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks for the call, Doug. And as we look ahead to this, our earlier guest, Ed Owen, was saying, putting this in the context of the American hostage crisis in Iran, in other words, not suggesting that this is likely to be resolved anytime soon. In that crisis, the United States eventually did try a military option, which, of course, we know ended in disaster at Desert One. Nevertheless, he says there is no military option for the British at this point. I don't think anybody knows where these sailors and Marines are being held. Are we in for another 444 days?
I think the quickness to which we nowadays are asking ourselves, is there a military option, is in and of itself an indication of how bad things have gone. Incidents like this, even under these type of very tense situations, should be looked at very carefully, and one should take a look at all different types of options and see what one can do before one starts to speculate, is there a military option? I think that's a sign of how, unfortunately, badly diplomacy is used these days.
Yet, from the other side, there has to be some concern over the way these people are being treated. Certainly, Iran may have some concern over the way their people may be being treated by the United States in Iraq. But nevertheless, confessions, as the British newspapers put it, have been extracted. These have been broadcast. Some of these are clearly not conversational English, shall we say.
Obviously, concern for the personnel is quite understandable, and then the question is, if that is the case, which it certainly is, what is the best way to getting them out? Discussing military options, etc., I doubt, is a good way of ensuring that this is resolved
Nobody
quickly.
In Britain seems to be discussing military
options. I think they've been very much discouraging any type of discussion about military option, because they know that is not the way to make sure that this can be resolved quickly.
Yet ratcheting up sanctions, more pressure from the United Nations Security Council, that seems inevitable.
I'm not so sure, again, if that was a very clever move. I don't know any specific instance in which the Security Council has been able to resolve an incident like this smoothly and in a timely manner. Rather, all that tends to do is to make the issue much more complicated, and that's exactly what it did this time. Again, I'm not saying that the Brits are wrong or right in this issue. I'm just wondering why some of these instruments have been and vehicles have been chosen to be used when they have been proven to be quite ineffective.
Trita Parsi, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Trita Parsi joined us. He's the author of Treacherous Alliances, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. He was with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, a former librarian tells us what libraries have to do when faced with the problem of dealing with the homeless. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.